Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people. It's good to see you again.
And Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello.
Yeah, hi.
So on After Things, we like to have the chance here to talk to people about things you're working on. And sometimes people send us questions, which we've got. We've got one, I think, from James Harrison, who has one. And then I'm going to do a quick aside. I had the pleasure Saturday of speaking over at UCLA for an extension course on like building your own sort of literary franchises. And I was there to talk about publishing and self-publishing and all that. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And it forced me to sort of think of like what would be the most important thing that I could condense down into and say, if I'm going to teach you one thing or tell you one thing, this is a thing I'm going to tell you, which we'll address at the end of the show. There's a little bit of a hook.
Cool.
Meanwhile,
real quick, if I can interject, I had a show night before last up in Schenectady, New York, and it was one of my first performing arts theater shows, like full on. They sold tickets to the public, and whoever bought it and so on. And it was really fascinating to have some of the audience know not just who I was, but like be fans of all the way down to the Weird Things and the BB Live show days and so on, and other people who had no idea who I was. But the most satisfying thing was that the fans all got together for an after party after the show. And I just want to give a quick thank you to everybody who put together doing that. It felt like a bit of a family reunion of a bunch of people who had never seen each other before.
You know, let's go into this question by James. I'll throw out there the one thing that I want to do, and then I want to spend the rest of the time talking about the show and getting ready for that, and what's going through your head as you're putting on a live thing. That's fascinating, and I want to dive into that. So first, let's just James asked this very, very poignant question. Says, have you ever been overwhelmed with a task? By which I mean you have found yourself looking at the big picture of the goal you're trying to achieve, and it grinds you to a halt. Did you have the answer to solve this? Did you succumb to the pressure at least once that made you decide today is a good day to visit the bookstore, new restaurant, hobby place? How did you get back on track? Thanks in advance, James Harrison. I don't think any of us can relate to this. I don't think we've ever dealt with this. So let's just move right on.
I mean, really, we're talking about the whole nature of biting off more than you could chew, where it's like you say yes because it's a great opportunity, and then you're faced with the reality of it. Justin, did you have a panic moment when it came to saying yes to the BitTorrent gig, or did that feel manageable the entire time through?
No. I mean, I don't think that those are really the issues where I hit that stuff. It's more the and I'm going to use an example that's not my example, but like, you know, when Andrew coming to me and saying like, this is my goal for publishing, you know, and then going from 0 to 100 of like, you know, the pathway between Andrew writing stuff that he gave to me and didn't publish, Andrew publishing something, and Andrew getting a deal to have those things appear in bookstores is a million different mini goals that from a distance look like this very simple 0 to 1, you know? And I think that those are really the things that tend to choke me up. And I think that's what James is talking about. But for me, I mean, really the biggest thing was, you know, probably making a living on podcasting. You know, that's obviously something that is a very seductive, easy thing to think of. Do a podcast. It gets popular. Make money. You're done. Right. And well, ultimately, it's a billion different mini goals to really get to there.
And it is a two-way street where it's like you set your target. You go from zero to something. As I'm fond of saying, like going from nothing to literally anything is the hard part. After that, it's a matter of fidelity. So let's say you have aimed for, you know, let's say one is targeted as something rather ambitious. Just as you can discover that you have more free time and bandwidth than you originally thought, and as a result are able to invest more to do it even better than your target was, the reverse is true as well. It's like, okay, at the end of the day, what is my obligation for this one public event? I am obligated to show up, do something, and collect a paycheck. What that something is, you know, if you're in a place where it's like, well, I don't have blank, I need so-and-so, there's not enough time to develop X, you can dial back the ambition of your goals and still satisfy to the extent that a client will be very, very happy with what you do. Like have you ever done that, Andrew, where it's like at the end of the day, you acknowledge like, look, at the end of the day, they don't really care how good this one trick is. What it is they want the guy from Don't Trust Andrew Maine to show up and be pleasant and make everybody happy. And then you sort of restructure everything from there.
First step, I break everything down into small steps as possible. I mean, that's me. Like, it's the big, huge thing. And like, when you say, I want to have a TV show, or I want to do something huge like that, that's so many moving parts, so many things there. If you try to think of everything that has to work, it will go insane. So you just say step one, step two, step three, step four. When it comes to those things you mentioned, like you're asked to go do this sort of challenging thing, I have my plan A and my plan B. Plan A is my ideal, everything I want to have go right. Plan B is my fallback, just get it done. So if I got a call that was like, oh yeah, we want you to go do a big magic show Friday, the first thing I'm going to sit down and do is take all the stuff that I do all the time that's super easy for me to perform, that I can do in my sleep, put that there. Literally sometimes just put that on a table, put that in a box, put this on a case and say, I've got this.
Yep.
I can go here and I can do 20 minutes, no problem. Now I'll go pull out the other stuff that's a little bit rusty or a little bit new to me or whatever and say, let me take one of these bits and see how far I get it going in the next couple of days. And then by Wednesday night, I'll decide what I'm going to do.
Well,
so what I do is I create my fallback. Like if I have a deadline for, let's say, like doing edits on a book and it's for a publisher, I'll go through and I'll do my first pass to get as much of it done as I can. And I'll say like, okay, here's some of the deeper things I want to do. Let me get this stuff done first. And then I can go dive deeper and really stress out of it if I have to. I find that one, I don't need to often do that other stuff, but two, I'm in a much better place because now I'm not worried about total failure.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it helps a lot. I don't want to speak on behalf of you gentlemen, but I suspect it's the kind of thing that if you ever find yourself overwhelmed by the task, a good thing to do is back up and ask yourself the question, what is it they're really buying? What is it they really want out of this? Do they really want your pickpocket show? Do they really want your magic show? Or do they want a successful party where everyone talks about how great a time they had and they want to come back next year? If it's the latter, all of a sudden you realize that there's a lot more tools at your disposal that you didn't realize. And that's very much, you know, what happened between the two shows that we did in Schenectady at this performing arts venue. It's like, okay, what is it that the people who are coming, there's two types of people. There are people who are coming because they hear there's a magic show. And then there's other people who hear that there's Brian Brushwood doing a thing. And knowing that allowed us to decide between the first show and the second show to say like, you know what? I bet a lot of people are fans of Scam School. You know what might be fun is if we actually taught a Scam School effect and brought that experience as if you're watching Scam School and participating and get them on stage. Breaking out of the straitjacket, so to speak, of thinking we have to do the stage show as it's always been done before, but instead thinking, what is it that people want? They want to show up, have an hour and change of entertainment time, feel like they're connected with Brian, and then go home happy. Allowed us to do things that were not on the menu for the main show that mm-hmm. I hadn't even considered before.
Yeah, you know, I think to the question, what I have always found, and I've certainly taken this from Andrew, is in breaking down, being like, there is a discipline in breaking down your tasks. Like there is a real, like you have to be hard on yourself and the task about what the smallest step forward can be. And if you start to conflate things then that's where you start to get into the really harmful area where you are now trying to do not only what you need to do first, but also thinking about step 7, 8, and 9. And now you are affecting your progress on step 1 because you're thinking about step 8, you know? And it's not to say that step 1's more important than step 8 or that you shouldn't be thinking about step 8. It's just that step 1 needs to get done in its entirety before you can start moving on. And that's to me where a lot of stuff in my personal work style winds up blowing up on the launch pad is I just short circuit because now I'm thinking about how to connect these two disparate steps as opposed to just finishing the first one.
I'm a big believer in, one, you break it down into concrete objective steps, a thing you do, not an outcome you wait for, not the universe telling you it's the right thing to do, but a physical thing you can do. When I get very stressed out, and I got a lot of projects right now that are stressing me out, I sit down and say, one, I need to go do this today. Wake up. This is my priority. Today I woke up. My priority was doing weird things. I know what I'm going to be doing for the rest of the afternoon. It's part of a much, 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 much bigger project. And it can be very daunting and frightening. And I kind of go, why am I doing this? Is this is just sort of wishful thinking, but I have to proceed. Now, the question James asked, like, do you just sort of like, you know, decide, hey, I'm going to go do something else, take my mind off of it? No. I learned that's the worst time to walk away from it because you teach yourself that's what you do when you're stressed out. If you teach yourself when you're stressed out to just not get the thing done, when you're dealing with even harder stress, more difficult things, you're less prepared. It's like working out. If you never push yourself past the pain limit, if you never put yourself to a point where you have to endure and do it, you're ill-equipped for it. So I'm a believer, like when I'm most stressed, that's when I put my most amount of attention to it. And I always find out like trying to write a book was, you know, years ago, 5, 6 years ago for me, that would have caused me a tremendous amount of stress. My brain would have been hurting. I would have been over, you know, it would have been short circuiting. I would have wanted to take naps. I would have wanted to do anything but focus on the problem. But I learned if I make it through, if I solve those problems and I deal with that pain, it becomes easier and easier and easier and easier. So now
the one thing I will say is that, yes, you need to get it done. And anything that makes you not get it done, you need to beat out of yourself. And I would say, for me, that includes talking about it. Like, I think we have a little safe space here where now we can all kind of have this meeting of the minds. But in general, I have found that the quickest way for me to not do something is to talk about doing the first step and that being it. Step two, you know, so we're working on this new card game, right? And there's a lot of theory crafting about theme and everything. And then at some point, you just got to write cards. You know, you just got to start doing the first draft, knowing that first draft is probably going to suck.
Right.
And you're going to have to make decisions that you have argued and battled for. And now you're going to put those up for judgment based on how people use them. But I knew that you just got to write them. Like, so the first thing that I did with John and working on it was setting up every Thursday. Here are our goals. Every Thursday, we set new goals at the end of every Thursday meeting, and we show up the next Thursday with our goals completed because we owe it to each other because this is a project that needs to move forward. Step two, I knew that I had to write these cards, and so I wound up kind of doing it in a place that I enjoyed, some place that made me happy that I was doing it. And that happened to be at this nice seafood bar down in Jack London Square in Oakland. It's nice. It's picturesque. Like, I can have a beer while I'm doing it, but I know that it has to get done. Like, so that was a little spoonful of sugar so I could get this done.
Is that one of those moments? Because I find myself doing this. There's you in the moment and there's you who's planning out the future. Is that a moment of like giving now you a reward for getting stuff done where it's like in my mind, and we've talked about this, like I think about my life as there's the real-time strategy game, which was me in this godlike vantage above saying, well, it's clear you have to go for this. And then there's me in the moment, this first-person shooter who's like, oh, crap, I really have to do this right now. I know that I schedule treats and bribes along the way where it's like, okay, yeah, if you get this done, you know, yeah, you can have a beer in the afternoon, but the trade-off is you got to get this done, that kind of thing.
I don't really believe in rewards necessarily. I do believe in like understanding my own productivity zone. And I don't necessarily respond tremendously toward like me punishing myself for productivity. So, but I do know that ultimately it just has to be done. So it's like, for me, it was dual facing. Number one, I tend to get, when I'm doing like stuff that I'm uncomfortable doing, which like writing first draft stuff tends to be very uncomfortable for me because I'm insecure and afraid. It helps when I'm out of my apartment because I can just be less comfortable when I'm out. I just know, I just like, all right, if I feel uncomfortable now, the quickest way for me to get home is to finish this. So go. And then, you know, the other side of it is being at a bar in a picturesque setting where that just, to me, was just a nice little like, hey, this is, I'm writing a card game that'll hopefully, you know, be a fantastic hit later in the year at this cool location. This is my life. I enjoy that. And that's cool. Like that to me is that like life affirmation kind of moment. And that makes me happy and to me makes me hopefully more productive. And it did that night. So that was my own little, you know, tax break to build the stadium.
I don't try to, I reward myself with the project. I don't tell myself if I do this, then I can go do this other thing, because that puts me in the mindset of that I'm not enjoying it. I want to convince myself that I enjoyed the work that I'm doing. And I think that it's one of the problems with like dieting is people are like, I want to diet. And like, oh, I found this ice cream that's got half the calories. I got this other thing and that'll be my little treat if I get it, if I exercise and do this, whatever. Well, all you're doing is you're just conditioning yourself to still use food as a reward. Even doesn't matter if it's diet or healthy for you or whatever. You're still having the same problem that you're telling your body when you do something good, feed yourself. And I think that if for me, and again, everybody's different, so I'm not going to say this is what you need to do. But for Andrew, I found that like when I was stressed out trying to finish a novel, I would teach myself to enjoy finishing an outline. I'd get excited about an outline and feel really good about, man, this outline feels really, really tight. I like this. I have this chapter breakdown with a really good opening and a really good closing. I like that. And when I get really, really stressed out and the brain is overloaded and I do have to distract myself, I would pick some other task within the overall meta task, what I was trying to do. So it might mean going into Photoshop and working on the cover, not as a tool for procrastination, which is a problem. You know, people will spend way more time trying to figure out how to do a cover or title a book than they will writing the book. If I'm working on it, what came from like working on magic tricks is that I would go figure out the magic trick. I'd try to shoot the trick on a Saturday in my living room. Then I would tell myself, okay, I can edit Sunday. I could never wait till Sunday. I would always upload the footage on Saturday night. And I'd tell myself, well, just make a rough cut. I'd put together a rough cut Saturday night. And then Sunday, that rough cut was kind of there like an elf did it. And it was so much easier to then trim it, add music. And then when I'd get really stressed out going over my edits, I would go into Photoshop and do stuff. I'd leave my camera equipment set up downstairs. So if I had to go grab extra shots, I could go do that. And I had a process where I could turn around, you know, a 40-minute magic DVD in a weekend, you know, on a Monday, call my distributor and have the DVD ready, the artwork ready, everything ready, because I never walked away from the task except to go eat. Everything else was spent working on it. And when it was really stressful doing certain parts of it, I went to a less stressful part of that.
So the question is, of course, about like, have you ever been overwhelmed with a task, by which I mean you find yourself looking at the big picture and want to walk away and it grinds you to a halt? Like, are we really just talking about procrastination? Because I know that writing is not difficult. Writing is a joy and you get in the flow and it's a lot of fun. Starting is sheer misery for me. I will do anything to avoid starting. But once I start, it's great. It's great.
It was the opposite for me when I started. I love to start projects. I love to start books. I didn't have the attention span. I could never finish anything past 35,000 words. And even that was a chore. I just couldn't. Once I had the first part of the idea, 500 words, 1,000 words was fun. That was fun. 10,000, 15,000, and then realizing I'm only a quarter of the way into a project. That was when it was very overwhelming, and that was when it was stressful for me.
That's interesting.
And I had to flip bit.
No, I mean that's where I'm at right now with this card game. Is that now I'm in the hard part where it's like we got cards, we know that they work enough that they can be the basis, but now the jokes are going to only get less funny. The questions about whether tenses and how much people are going to fill in little stuff is what we're focusing on. And now it's going to be putting a lot of this stuff out in people's hands that, you know, now you got to face harsh truths about, you know, what's good and what works and what doesn't. That's all that little, you know, ego depleting element that is what ultimately makes it good. That's the polishing.
That's, you know, so interesting because I don't know that I've thought deeply about this. So I apologize if this is a half-baked idea. But I've often thought that when it comes to creative endeavors, there are people who love the blank page because it's a blank canvas and they can put whatever they want on it. And that to me is like people who love to begin. I am not that. I want very much a lump of clay where I can look at it, or maybe a chunk of obsidian, and look at it and sort of half see, like, I think I see what's in there trying to get out. But it sounds like both of you guys are more fans of the blank page. Like I love finishing. I love completing. I hate starting because starting is so intimidating for me.
My problem is I start too many things. I start way too many things. And it's following through. And a lot of things I do too. And it depends upon the length of things too. It was one thing for me to want to do a magic video, which is asking me to take 3 days to go do it. You know, if I'm doing a novel, which if I can work at the pace that I'm really comfortable with will be 2 weeks, but sometimes it could be 3 months. That's the daunting part, because it's like, this is going to be my life for a considerable amount of time. And when I do a novel with a publisher, I'm going to write that book, and a year later, it's going to come back and I'm going to have to do edits and stuff. And then 18 months later, I'm going to have to go in and publicize and talk about this thing and be, you know, excited about it. So for me, starting is easy. Finishing's hard, because some of these projects are just huge, huge, huge commitments.
That's man, now the more that I think about it, the more I'm realizing how much I deeply adore fixing other people's problems. Because, like, whenever I'm socially talking to someone who has a creative endeavor, I can't wait to hear about it, because this is something midway. It's in process, and I can hear it with a fresh perspective and say, well, have you considered cutting this out or changing this or whatever? That's – wow. I don't think I'd ever realize that about me.
So I'm going to just touch back quickly to the one piece of advice that I gave when I spoke on Saturday that was the most important one I think I could offer, and it sort of relates to this, and then I want to dive into your show, Brian. And that is, we've talked about this before, make something. And in case of James, if you're working on a project, finish something. If it's a business plan, finish the business plan. If it's a script for a movie, finish the script before you start casting and doing all these things. Finish the other parts of the process and have that done. Get in the habit of being somebody who finishes things, not starts things, but finishes things. Because I talk to people all the time now who are like, I've been working on this book for 2 years and maybe I want to do this other thing. Like, no, finish that damn book. If you have a business idea, follow through, unless it's going to bankrupt you or it's a complete stupid waste of time. If you've never finished anything, you're a person that's never finished anything. If you finish something, it's why do venture capitalists and angel investors, why do they want to invest in people who've already started businesses, even if the businesses were a failure? Because they made something. So
yeah,
make something.
And even then, there are so many lessons to be learned on you ending a product or a project instead of it dying on the vine. You know, like, there is once you've seen stuff to the end, like, if you got a business plan, you can get to the point where you're looking at properties and, you know, that you want to open a store or something like that, and you understand some of the realities about the market and say, you want to know what? Maybe not now. Let me say that this isn't for me right now. There's a tremendous worth to having the ability to unplug, but you don't know even what that is until you've gotten from zero to one.
The risk, I don't want to muddle that message though, because it's like, yes, absolutely right. There's, you know, there's the importance of when to walk away. But if you've walked away from every effing thing in your life, pick something you're not going to walk away from. Pick something that's not going to bankrupt you, whatever, because the number one problem I have when I see people who are creative is they walk away from stuff, and they walk away from stuff, and they'll find the reason not to. Like, yes, before you even think about doing that business where you've got to sign that bank loan and you've never made anything, you've never even, like, you know, never even made enough food to, you know, if you're opening up a restaurant for a party or whatever, find a small scale thing, low risk, high work to do and to finish that thing. get that done before you start doing the bigger things. I had big ambitions. I wanted to do TV. I wanted to do this stuff. I never finished a damn thing. I had everything I'd ever had came easy to me. And I had to, you know, for me, it was making a movie. It was making, you know, a low budget movie, like super low budget movie that wasn't going to be any good. But seeing that thing through to the end, even though I knew halfway through, I'm like, I've learned so much. If I were to do this again, it would be 10 times better. I'm like, yep. And so with the next project, the next project, the next project, something.
That's why, I guess that's a corollary to the, you know, I will make better mistakes tomorrow, or fail faster, fail smarter, fail better. Like the only way to know, the only way to fail smarter is to actually fail. And the way that you do that is you finish a thing. And it's very, very tempting to constantly keep something in the purgatory of it's being worked on. I didn't write a bad novel. I am writing this novel. And you can keep on be writing it till the end of your days. And that's not the right way to go. Finish the damn thing. Say, I wrote a novel. Like, the hardest thing in the last 15 years for me has been the transition to using the phrase, I toured with a magic show, past tense. I toured full time for 15 years with a college magic show, to put that in the archival shelf of things I did past tense, and to explain, but now I do internet video and television, blah, 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 blah. And yes, you know, I could still do the show and we'll of course talk about that, but to put it in the I wrote past tense a stage show. I wrote past tense a lecture. I created past tense Scam School. That is a challenging thing to do to make that transition, and it's an important one.
But getting things done. So let's talk about this, Brian. I didn't know you were doing shows this weekend.
Yeah.
What happened? Where did this come from?
Over a year ago, we were talking. I got a call from Ethan at Proctor's Theater, performing arts venue in Schenectady, New York. He was somebody who came across Hacking the System, really dug it, dove in, discovered Scam School, discovered that I had a stage magic show, and said, hey, I would love to bring you into the performing arts theater world. And I was like, great. I normally do colleges, which is, you know, a few college students on a student activities board make a decision, and then I show up and do the show on college's dime. And of course, it's a scary, exciting, terrifying thing to get an accurate measurement of what your brand is worth in the real world. It is the most artistically honest endeavor I can think of, to basically announce to the world, I will be here at this place and this time. Who wants to show up, and how much money are you willing to give? And it was great. We did two shows on Saturday, a 3:30 and a 7:30. And we did what? 400 over 300 for each.
About 300 for each is what heard, maybe.
But it, and on top of that, there were some people who traveled as far as, you know, 7 hours to come out and see the show. And the most satisfying part, of course, as we often see with the Diamond Club Chat Realm crew, is that they put together their own meetup afterward, and it was this awesome, surreal experience. It was like a family reunion where there's people that you know you are blood relatives with that maybe you've never met face to face, and you find yourself connecting with, asking, what can I do to help you? What are you up to? You know, what's going on? It was utterly, utterly delightful, and I'm really, really proud. And turns out I remember how to do my show, which was very exciting for me to realize.
How much prep did you do leading up to the show?
A lot. A lot of it was mental stuff, reaching back and remembering specific routines, a lot of talking through the scripts on stuff. But out of everything, the hardest thing was the logistics, because I had to pack for the show knowing that not me would be the one to bring the trunks. I had to pack everything and then just leave a note for Bryce saying, hey, pick up these three trunks, meet me in Schenectady, and hopefully we'll do a show. And luckily, it's not like it's a miracle, but, you know, after 15, 20 years of doing this, there's a bit of muscle memory as far as, like, I know I need this, three sheets of poster board, two red apples, this, that, the other thing. It was really neat doing them back to back, because the first episode, first performance, you could very much tell I was like, okay, let's not screw anything up. I was like, let's get through this and not miss a thing. And the second one was really so much more fun because I had finished the first one. We knew everything was where it needed to be. We knew we had everything. It was on rails, and you could see me journeying into all these improvisational moments. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
Are we going to see more of this?
I would like to. I would like to. I think it's a good show. It's kind of weird to watch your own show from the outside with the benefit of having a little bit of a break. I will real quick. I just want to give mad props to Bryce Neshcom Castillo, who turns out knows the show as well as I do now and was able to handle everything on the fly. It was really good.
Yeah, thanks. You're welcome.
So Friday, Mr. Marcus Eddy and I drove up to Las Vegas, and we saw David Copperfield perform, and then we hung out with our friend Chris Kenner. Got to talk to David a little bit, which was really cool, and then hung out with Chris, then drove back. And every time I go there and I go see that show, and you look at, you know, you look at this huge auditorium, and you're thinking, like, if you look at, like, in Vegas, other magicians and other acts there, you'll see they do maybe 7 shows a week or 8 shows a week, and David does 15 shows a week, and David gets twice as much per ticket.
Yeah.
And it's insane to think about the amount of work, the amount of effort it takes. You know, he's the most famous magician in the world, but to put him butts in seats, you know, it's, and it's done. Like, David's a hugely successful show. And that's, you know, due in large part to Chris Kenner, who's, you know, a friend of ours who I think we've even had on these microphones at some point before. And that's sort of the daunting thing, because you have this, you know, if I write a book, I have a book, but now I've got to get everybody to know the book is out there to tell them about the book. You know, Brian, you're going to go to New York, go do shows. And it's like, you've got a great show. I've seen your show. Your show is fantastic. And it's, how do you get the word out? How do you put butts in seats? How do you tell people what's going on? And that would be, for me, that'd be one of the most terrifying things about what you had to go do was, you know, how do you get everybody, convince everybody, hey, come do this.
Well, and that's one of the benefits, and I'm sure Justin could speak to this, of having a commodity act. That was the hardest thing when I started going full time, is that I refused to call what I did a magic show, because if you say a magic show, then that seems like something you would book for a 9-year-old's birthday party. It's a very specific set. The phone does ring and people say, I need a magician. The phone does ring and they say, I need a hypnotist. The phone does ring and they say, I need a dance troupe. The phone does not ring and somebody says, I need somebody who has a quirky show filled with moments where somebody eats fire and then sticks nails in their eyes and blah, 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 blah. So that means if you're going to sell the show, it has to be on the value of your brand as you've built it. And, you know, it's interesting. And I suppose this last weekend was validating, but, you know, you never know. You're like, how many people are there to see Brian Brushwood? And how many people are there to see a magic show, you know? And so you don't know unless you try, right?
What was that? What was the makeup of that? Like, how many kids, were there kids there? What was the sort of the demographic?
There were a lot of kids. What would you say, Bryce? I would say at least 50% of the people there had seen some stuff, whether it was Scam School or Hacking the System or whatever.
I feel like you had a better idea because you
I met everybody afterwards. Yeah.
But there were a lot of kids. It was a 10 and up show, I think.
Yep.
So there were some kids there, yeah.
And there were some younger kids before, and it was interesting to try to prime the audience from one show to the next. Like, the first show, we just went in cold, and it was clear to me. I was like, well, the people who don't know who I am have no idea what to expect. So the second show, like, I kind of asked, and Ethan was a little bit cold on the idea of, like, well, they're here to see you. Won't that ruin the mystery if you're out there meeting them beforehand? And I was like, well, I think I'd rather do that and have them know what to expect and be excited for it than the alternative. So the second show, like, everybody who showed up early, I individually shook their hand and met them. And they're like, hey, you're here for the show. Do you know what to expect? Oh, you don't. Oh, get ready for a little blood and guts. Get ready for a lot of, you know, twisted stuff.
Yeah, it's a different – it's – you know, the pro and con of, like, hey, do I want to come across as this, you know, this sort of super mysterious person? But sometimes it's like, man, I want to befriend everybody before I go up there, because it's like when you're not, you know, if you're David Copperfield and they watched your TV special, then they know who they're going to go see.
Right.
But when you're, you know, not David Copperfield,
you know, AKA us.
Yeah. You know, and it's this, you're like, I need them to like me. I need them to be excited to see me there. Pardon me, et cetera. I think I've done that before where I'll just work it a little bit, just make some friends beforehand. So people are liking me and all that. And see that, you know, I'm not aloof. It's that the pro con. Do you want to be mysterious or do you want to be liked? And sometimes the two go together.
Justin, in all the time that you covered magicians in iTricks, do you have like a gut read on the difference between playing up the mysterious angle versus the personable angle?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that there are, you know, there are some people for whom I think want to put up a large kind of front there. But in general, I was in a weird place because anytime that I would talk to people, they were always just kind of blown away that I wasn't a magician. And that it was like any kind of, non-magic press. Because I was always more on the lines of like, oh, I'm like the local newspaper person that's talking to you, but I'm not just going to ask the dumbest questions ever, you know. But certainly that there is a weird dichotomy between magicians talking to lay people and magicians talking to other magicians. And I was I think I benefited and the site benefited from being in that mushy middle, actually.
Yeah.
And I guess that to the question of like, does it help a magician to be more mysterious when they're in front of an audience or not, to be likable or not? I think it depends upon the magician. You know, yeah. Penn and Teller make themselves extremely accessible. You know, Penn and Teller after the show, they're hanging out in the lobby, they're talking, whatever, because one, when you're Penn and you're a giant, you can do that. You know, David Copperfield would go used to sign, you know, do sign autographs on the edge of the stage, and that's there. And I think it does come from if you're a populist sort of approach person, or if you're, you know, you're supposed to be like, hey, no, I just came here in a Learjet. I got to go leave. I'm super important, whatever. It depends, you know, it's like, I was talking to Marcus about this, that like, I try not to like, if I can deal directly with people, I try to do that, you know, for stuff like if handling problem situations, things like that, because I don't want it to look like, oh, we'll talk to my assistant or the person that handles this sort of thing, because I want to make myself approachable. That's part of who my brand is. Sometimes, though, you have to. If I'm doing a corporate show, they're going to be talking to, you know, the person who I bring on to be a producer. They're going to talk to the person who I bring on to handle logistics, because I know when I'm asking for a stupid amount of money for something, they can't be talking to me and dealing with me, because then in their mind, and it's the dumb way it works, is they just sort of like, oh, well, they're more impressed by the BS sort of thing of having other people around you.
Well, and that's one of those things where it's like, let's say it's a corporate holiday party, then the person who's in charge of a corporate holiday party, let's say they have an outrageous budget of $20,000. Do you think that person who's put their name and face on the line, spending $20,000 of corporate money for this big holiday party, do you think they're going to feel better or not great about you gawking around making friends before and after the show? Is that going to look like they invested in a superstar and that you're privileged to be able to have that? Or is that going to look like they paid for a schlub who's hobnobbing with a hoi polloi before and after his show? So it's
And even, you know, Brian, you just had a situation where there was like a question about licensing footage, right? Like,
yeah,
you doing it personally and making it seem like this is just your vlog is different than what you wound up doing, which was literally just, you know, in the grand context, everything wasn't a gigantic thing for you, but you passed it off to somebody else to be like, hey, congratulations, you're now the head of licensing. Please go ahead and negotiate this deal.
Yeah.
So now even the fact that that's there, for somebody that's deciding what to do with other people's money, they're going to peel off probably a little bit more than other people's money, because now we are in a business transaction where like we can either walk away or not do it. And it's not just like, hey, let's take advantage of this YouTube kid. Here's 5 cents.
That's actually a really good point. There is so much value to introducing a third party into things. And whether that third party is, you know, your wife, your spouse, your boss, your whatever, or the third party doesn't even have to be a person. It can be your policy. Like somebody asks you to do a thing and you don't want to do it. You could say like, well, my policy is to not do this for less than dollar amount. And then he's like, but I really like your thing and I'd love to figure. So somebody offers you $1 to do your pickpocket show. You can say, well, my policy is to never do a gig for less than $100, but I really like your event and I'd love to make this work. How can we work together to defeat, that third party, the policy, so much trouble. All of a sudden people will react differently when you and them appear to be on the same side trying to overcome a challenge. And that's what happened on the licensing thing is they offered, the first opening bid that was ludicrously low. And so we responded, well, you know, the standard licensing fee for this content is blank. And it was, 5-6 times as much. And he's like, but I really like your show. How can we meet in the middle? And it turns out we met more than the middle. They got most of the way there because it opened up because there was a third party boogeyman that was neither of our fault. And we worked together to overcome them.
What is, I love having an agent for certain negotiations. And I've had people who like wanted to acquire rights and stuff like, oh, can't we just talk? I'm like, that's things just came out of your mouth are exactly why I have an agent for that situation. You know, not everything I do goes through an agent. Some things like, nope, this is what this is or whatever. But you know, when I'm dealing with people who negotiate all day long on these kinds of things and have more experience than I do, I'm like, the last thing I want to do is like, you know, mention number. And I'll talk to me like, oh, we'll go talk about a project, whatever. Like, oh, we don't talking. Can we talk about this part? I'm like, no, that's for the adult to discuss.
Yeah.
No, not for me, because that's where it gets sticky. That's absolutely where it gets sticky. But so positive experience for you, I assume. It's interesting looking at like what's on tour right now. You know, Adam Savage is doing his Brain Candy tour with
the guy from Veritasium.
Vsauce.
Yeah. Vsauce.
And Michael Carbonara is doing his tour, which seems to be, I'm hearing great. Did you see that show?
I did. I took my daughters to go see it. It was a delightful stand-up show, and it actually was one of those definitive moments where Michael Carbonaro's show is brilliantly well thought out, super charming, a delight to watch. However, it's also very clear that he's doing it on a stage for 3,000 people, but he could just as easily do that exact show for 50 people, and it would be delightful. And watching that and seeing so many people enjoy it so much was a big part of me thinking like, well, I could do my show for a lot of people as well. He's got a fantastic white hot show and brand out there. Absent that, it's a big reason of why I wanted to do the performing arts gig, because I was curious how many folks would pony up, $20 to $30 to see my silly show.
Cool. So, I mean, I think there's a great big future in live entertainment. We're seeing a lot of the feast, they have Adam Savage and then the guy from the internet together doing a show, which shows you the power and the strength of that. And that, Brian, you got the gig because a guy saw you on Nat Geo, but most of the people who showed up to see you showed up because of this stuff.
Yeah. Because of scam school and stuff just like this. And by the way, you could tell who was family by who kept handing me things to sign that had Harambe on it. I got Harambe'd 7 times that day.
You got Harambe'd 7 times?
No, it was a lot. It might as well have been.
Someone came up after the show to me and was like, can I get your autograph? And he was a Harambe.
Yeah, no.
He got me.
Yeah, no, no. It was
oh my God.
A lot of Harambe-ing going on.
Hilarious. Do we have any picks, any recommendations?
Literally read any book on negotiation at all. Like, that's my pick. Like, just go to Amazon, type in the word negotiation.
Part of the deal, Brian's pick.
No. Oh, man, look at that. Bryce wrote the same thing in. That was ghostwritten. That's not a real thing. Read a good book. As a matter of fact, here, I got one. Type in negotiation at the Great Courses. Go to the Great Courses. All of them are awesome lectures. Type in negotiation. You'll be very, very happy.
Is that The Great Courses .com is a service.
Correct. As a matter of fact, one of the guys, I don't remember who said it, but he tells the story that he's about to be introduced live on stage, and they're talking up his negotiation course, and he happens to be in the back of the room, and he overhears one of the people attending saying, "Oh, you better watch out for this guy. He'll get the fillings out of your teeth." And the guy taps him on the shoulder and says, "Oh, excuse me, technically that's not a negotiation. Negotiation is where I get the fillings out of your teeth and you thank me for it." Like, that's negotiation.
Excellent. I'm going to just double down on your pick.
Yeah. So I found myself in a weird position. I was asked to host this corporate thing, and they asked me for my contract. And I'm like, well, yeah. That's I'll be right there with my personal appearance contract. And so I wound up getting one. I think it was like findlegalforms.com. It was like $8 for a standard personal appearance contract. It made it really easy to fill in all the different things. You know, I brought it in, edited it, used HelloSign to upload it there and mark the places where it needed to be signed and send it to them. So it was really, really easy, but downloading that and then uploading it to HelloSign was the easiest way to do it. But it was easier than I thought it was going to be, and also pretty cool to have that problem.
Yeah,
and
congrats.
I'll tell you something too, that like, man, like if you ever have to do anything entertainment related or whatever, and you're going to get an attorney, make sure they actually really do that kind of stuff, because like, I've come across multiple stories from people that had attorneys or whatever handle stuff for them, and you find out that they weren't. Because there are attorneys who say, "I specialize. I don't do this. I'll put you in touch with somebody." And then their attorneys are like, "Oh, I can do that." That's where you got to worry about it, because yep. The "I can do that" means they don't deal with these things on a daily basis. They think they're so smart they can see everything. I remember like the first contract I ever had. You know, I asked some friends, "Do you know anybody?" And I got this in Florida. Somebody said, "Oh, I got so and so can handle this for you." Then I call up a guy. It was like a guy I went to college with, a friend of mine. Like, "Oh, yeah, I can handle that." And he looks at it like, "No, that's pretty good, whatever. And this is rate, whatever." And I look at it, and there are like five things he missed because he'd never really negotiated an entertainment contract. Mm-hmm. And I went out and got a much better attorney to go handle that. But that happens a lot. We get these things. We get scared because of this, and we don't even read it. You don't even look at it. And there's so much better stuff out there, like things like that, where you can – it's a great place to start from. So you don't want to sometimes go out and hire an attorney to go do it, because it's more than you're going to make. But get those – I found pretty good success with a number of those sort of ready-made sort of things. And a lot of attorneys are like, "Oh, don't use those." It's like, yes, in the hypothetical magical world where I have infinite amount of money to spend on this thing, right. Yes, you know, do this. I have an attorney I use for some things, and then I have other things I'm like, I will go over this with my business partner, whatever, and decide what we're going to do. But there's a lot more resources out there.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're dealing with a big, long, multi-date kind of thing, or something that has a lot of, like, you know, profit participation based on sales and stuff like that, then, yeah, you might want to look into somebody that knows what the hell they're doing. But this is like, it's a one-off thing that's going to happen for 4 hours. And it's like, I really don't need to go find an entertainment lawyer to, you know, in on that.
Yeah. You want something that's had some attention to it. Cause you do want to make sure that, like, even in a person, like, again, like, yeah, it's not worth it. The risk reward version of that. Cause like, you sometimes though, like, you do want to be careful, because like, you're up on stage, you're emceeing, and somebody falls down in the aisle and trips and decides to sue you, and you find out like, oh, every entertainment contract I would have had would normally have said that I'm not liable for that. And that's where those little things come into play. And that's where an attorney goes. That's why you need an attorney. It's like, yeah, but I would have spent my entire fee on an attorney. That's why you guys do this. My advice is, when you really need to, make sure it's an actual attorney that specializes in what you do. Don't be afraid to ask, well, how much of this sort of stuff have you done? Who are some of your clients? What have you done? When I need to do magic contracts or entertainment contracts or anything like that, I use the same guy David Copperfield uses, you know, because he's
because got some
experience.
Can.
Gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.